Thank you for listening to this Podcast One production. Available on Apple Podcasts and Podcast One.
That's awesome. Awesome.
That's awesome.
Awesome. Awesome.
Oh, dude, that's awesome.
That's
awesome.
Really awesome.
Awesome.
That's, so
that's awesome.
Awesome.
Oh, awesome. That's
awesome.
With Stephen Bradford. Stevie B!
What up, dude?
Yo, buddy.
My voice is a little rough, but whatever.
You say rough, I say sexy.
Okay,
I mean,
thank you.
Say potato, I say
hi.
Sexy.
What's your name? McBain.
Hi. Dude, there's McBain.
Dude, if I had this voice all the time like this, this would be amazing.
Sure would.
Hey,
sure.
What's up, girl?
I mean, you speak sometimes in hushed tones on the show. I remember when I came on the show.
A little bit, yeah.
I was like, God, these people talk quietly. And I'm like, hey guys, I'm over here.
Yeah, can we get the helium guy out of here, please?
And then Steve and Kelly are like, I'm like, are you guys, can you speak up? What?
Are you doing a scene or not?
What?
I know. And then like, Maurice, you know, he would always get the note, more voice. And he'd be like,
oh,
that was the one that would set him off. More voice.
And then here comes the bark.
More voice.
Here comes the bark.
Here comes the sunny bark. So, dude, we got an awesome guest today.
I mean, dude.
I'm so excited.
I want to say thank you to you for securing said guest.
Yes.
And, I mean, you told me that there was a possibility we could get him in the past, and it sounded like you were just like a text message away, and I was like, really? That's kind of amazing. just because, like, for me, this is, you know, someone that I would just love to talk to, and we got the chance to do it today.
Yeah, it's amazing.
And it's great. So, folks, enjoy. Well, Steve, some people like to call you a legend.
I don't know if that's the word that first comes out of people's mouth when they think of me.
But for sure. we have a legend with us.
Dude, no, it's amazing.
Yeah,
it's
I think
amazing.
That's what it is. Yes.
For sure. Hey.
Joining us from an undisclosed location in somewhere on the East Coast. Corbin Burnson's here.
Corbin Burnson.
Yeah, baby.
This is amazing.
Yeah, here we are.
I'm so excited.
Okay. All these years.
Is that a turtleneck?
No, my turtlenecks are upstairs. I gave up the turtleneck for today. You know, I'm living in a I read a book or an article about, you know, all these guys were really brilliant, like Steve Jobs, they all had like black turtlenecks. It was for a reason. It's like you become neutral and everything else becomes important. And that's when I had to stop wearing turtlenecks because, I mean, I have them, but I risk feeling sort of pseudo intellectual, you know, so no, this is just a black tee. You have to wear t-shirts under sweaters here. It gets,
I got a black t-shirt.
That's right. Steve knows all about black t-shirts.
That's just straight Steve Burton.
Yeah.
Corbett. Man, well, this is incredible to catch up with you. It's been a while. It's been since Young and the Restless I saw you.
Yeah, but you know, I mean, think about how far back it really goes in different variations.
No, here's what's crazy, because I never really like Google anybody, but I'm like, I better Google Corbin or I'm dead. So you did an episode of Out of This World.
Out of This World? What the heck is that?
it was a sitcom that I was on in 1991.
Come on.
Yeah, with Donna Pascal, Doug McClure.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Yeah, now it sounds, yes, yeah. Wow.
And I was not there, obviously, that week because I would have remembered. I go, what? We go all the way back to 1991.
Wow. I mean, I go look at my IMDb and I want to throw up. It's just it's
what do you mean? Stuff. It's amazing.
Yeah, you know, it's filled with I read an obituary of a woman yesterday who calls herself a B actress. I guess she was a penthouse model, but it was on Deadline or something.
Yeah, I saw that too. Yeah.
She died, right? And it said she had an amazing list of over 100 film credits. I'm going like, well, if that's amazing and that's what made her B, then I'm an F actor because I have about 8,000 things.
That's not true.
I don't want them saying, Steve, whatever I do when I go, please don't let them just put the top three, would you please?
what are the top three?
Top three things I'm proud of that I really care about in this world. Actually, I can't say three, but maybe 10. It'd be certainly L.A. Law, because that's where I started. certainly, you know, things, little things like hosting Saturday Night Live.
That's awesome.
Major League movies would have to be in there. In the television world, I did an episode of Seinfeld, but that's just sort of like, oh, okay, you did that. Y&R, because it has so much other meaning for me, you know, with my mom.
And your mom, yeah.
Part of a continuing legacy, if you will. Things are important. I did an incredible, one of the first times they let me in television after LA Law, I did a TV movie called The Morris Dees Story. Morris Dees was the head of the Southern Poverty Law Center. Really a guy fighting for civil rights and all that. And it was the first time I got to play a character. I actually, when I had hair, I did a perm, which I looked really stupid in.
Oh, I doubt that. That sounds amazing.
But I played this guy. But the night, and I did a lot of work. I met with more. I did all the stuff you're supposed to do as an actor that you have the, when you have the time to do it and they kind of pay you to do. And I went deep with this, with the way he talks and looks and everything. And spending hours and hours with him trying to understand what made him tick. Because he also had this other side that he actually sort of got in trouble for later about just the kind of guy he was. Let's not go into all that. But the night it aired, the Iran war broke out.
Oh,
and
gosh.
We got preempted.
Wow.
It was like, I don't know if you remember, if you can go back that far. It was like, we launched missile. Oddly enough, Iran.
Yeah.
They're not going to do anything this week.
Yeah, right. So it never aired?
I think it did, but it was kind of just shoved into it later.
Like late,
I
don't think 3 a.m. or something?
It was really good, and I think I did a good job on it. I think at the end of the day, it just couldn't hold value to all the stuff that was going on, and then it became stale, and all the interviews we did, it just became stale. It was on, and it kind of came and went.
Right. So I just want to get a little bit of a recap of your life and how it all started. We don't, you know, you don't have to go into super detail, but obviously your mom, Jeannie Cooper's in the business.
Right.
So did you grow up out here?
I grew up out there. My mom and dad were both. My dad was a producer. He used to be an agent. He was the kind of agent that, you know, you wish you always had. And we've shared our own agent manager kind of story.
Yes, we have, sir.
But he was a guy who was before managers, you know, when agents were your sort of press person, your agent, your manager, your, you know, they did all that stuff. You know, my dad hand walked so many people. He was a part of the whole having to hide people who were gay, you know, and make sure they were women. But that's not when it's just when you were truly, it was like, you know, Irving's my agent, you know, Harry Brinson's my agent. He was that guy and keenly interested in the business and the people, but saw a lot of people make a lot of money where he was a 10 percenter and started producing and then failed. Anyway, and actually all of that sort of destroyed the relationship with my mom and another long story. So I was born into the business. I used to go with my mom, go see Bonanza being made, different things. I fell in love with, oddly enough. Steve, you guys probably know this. You know, you walk onto a stage, it's like a park or something. It's got that artificial smell that we associate with landscaping.
Yes.
It's the trees and stuff. And you go, oh. And I remember walking to the Bonanza set, which was incredible, the Ponderosa, you know, there on a soundstage at Paramount. And I'd seen it on TV like anybody else. And not only was my mom in it, but it was just this false, fake world that was so fascinating. To this day, I mean, I love it. If I'm working on a lot somewhere, I would walk around, even Y&R, I used to walk over to B&B, you know, just to, you know, just, I just get fascinated by sets and things.
Yeah.
And I fell in love with it, went to UCLA, tried to avoid it for the longest time. Didn't want to be with my parents, didn't want to be in the business that destroyed them and so many other people, but it was in me. I put an Oliver in my backyard when I was a kid, me and two guys somehow did the entire play of Oliver.
That's impressive.
Yeah. And I fell in love with it, went to UCLA, finally started out in pre-law, hated it, gave up at 19 and said, no, I want to do this. My dad actually gave me a part in a black exploitation movie that he was one of the guys who produced, one of the first, called Three the Hard Way, where I got to make out with this hot chick, get $900, and they blew up my van and blew up my car, and I got a van in return. I said,
this is it.
Screw philosophy and law. I'm an actor. Went straight to UCLA, did 4 years there, then got my master's degree in playwriting, did the requisite trip to New York to go beat the pavement, built a theater there with some people, got a deal with NBC, which became LA Law.
Wow.
So, and that was through an audition, or how did you, how did that?
I had auditioned for an incredible sitcom. I think it was with Judith Light, oddly enough.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
And it was going to be you and not Tony Danza. Is that how it was going to go?
Oh, yeah. And this is maybe it was Judith Ivy. I get confused. It's so far back there. An incredible sitcom, really real, kind of that one of those Norman Lear real things, not this laugh track stuff.
Sure.
Didn't get, flew out to LA. Tested me, another guy got it, but they said, we love you, we're gonna put you under contract once you go on the show. For about a year, they kept sending stuff and had audition or meet people, and finally met the guys with LA Law, and had, and you guys know this, I had the network behind me.
Sure.
No, I mean, they're paying me, so it's like, right. Please find the show.
Right. Please.
And it ultimately became LA Law, which I didn't get in LA, but Stephen Bochco in the audition said, hey, you're great. If you ever come to LA, please, we'll use you in something. Split up with my wife in New York, drove straight to LA like the week after. And it was only there in the sunshine and, you know, beautiful girls and Jeeps, you know, driving by that I finally went, oh, this is this character, you know, not right. The guy that I was in New York, which was sort of doing dark plays.
Right. Of
at course. LA Law. And then in LA Law, worked with a director named Greg Hoblit, who I just had lunch with the other day. And I thanked him because he told me back then, and my mother taught me this, and you guys know this if you knew my mom at all, he always said, make it about the work, just make it about the work, and the rest of the stuff, you know, as much as we get in there and want the fame and the play the big game, I've never been comfortable with that stuff. Mm-hmm. Not only comfortable, it's just I saw what it did. It's not, I was grew up in the business, so I saw what it did to people. It wasn't a thing. It's always about the work, always about the work, always about the work. And I followed the work. You know, I followed the work to make money when we didn't have money. I followed the work to raise four kids and not worried about like, oh, is this the right step in my career? Is this the, you know, am I making the right move?
Am I doing this?
I kind of, you know, begrudgingly made those kinds of moves in my life. And to this day, touch wood, I still work, you know? And, you know, will I ever be, you know, when they do the, you know, they do the thing, the, you know, will I ever be a legend? We started back there. I don't really know. I don't really care. Right. It's nice to think you become something that people talk about. It's more important to me than my four sons and my wife. Well, my four sons anyway, my wife certainly, but you know, think of it. I was a decent guy that I provided for them. I did the best I could. I fucked up some places I didn't, you know. Yeah, but I always was trying to do the right thing for family. And that's really what it's been about. So if I have to do a job I don't really care about, some terrible TV movie, okay.
Right.
Right. Yeah. I mean, Corbin, that's an awesome attitude. And since I've known you, you've always been such a generous, nice guy, you know, so down to earth with stuff. And you always had your priorities straight, which has been so cool to watch. And to this day, like you're still, I mean, we've crossed paths so many times, but you've produced movies, you've directed movies, you've written movies. You're still doing that now, which is awesome.
Well, I've been working on I'm going to do, now that I've landed up here where I live, this area is really fertile with both, you know, tax incentives and reasons to make stuff. I'm in the Hudson Valley in New York, and a lot of talent up here. A lot of people, a lot of like-minded people who've, you know, somehow got that notion you got, Steve. I mean, every years ago, when you said, I'm out of here, taking my family somewhere. But yeah. A lot of people ended up here because of the art. So now that we're settled here, I've created a series that I want to do called Blind Eye. And it sort of steps out of these movies I've been making, which is somewhat faith-based. And I want to do it locally up here. That's the thing. I want to make film. I'd like to make things and not have to travel too far.
Yeah, right. No kidding, huh? I know. Bradford and I are on the road so much now. We're like, hey, road, how are you? So.
I did last year, we can say it now because it is last year. I was working on two shows, The Resident in Atlanta, and this new show that comes out, I think February 6th. We have recurring parts in both, called Tommy. Which is going to be
The Edie Falco show, right?
Edie Falco show.
Yeah.
I play the ex-mayor of Los Angeles, ex-chief of police of Los Angeles, but get thrown out because of you know, go figure, sexual harassment crap. and she takes over my job.
Okay.
I was flying so much. I was saying to my wife last night, I was like, you know, I kind of don't know what to do with myself now because I don't have to. Oh, that would be Siri stepping in. Sorry,
Siri, you are not a part of this.
Yeah, it's not a, it's not about you, Siri.
What is that, man? Between Siri and Alexa, I'm doomed.
I know.
But yeah, I was flying all over the place. Didn't know what suitcase, what, when, where.
Right. Yeah. So you were, you've been writing for forever since you were in college. So
yeah, I got my master's degree in playwriting back then.
Right.
Not so they let me in the acting program.
Ah, I see. So have, when you were a kid thinking about getting into this and you were on sets, were stories in your head or?
Stories have always been in my head. I've a hard time, even with my wife, she doesn't quite get it. I don't judge anything. I don't judge what's going on in the country. I don't judge Trump. I don't judge it, get into a thing of like, oh, he said this. I don't judge the people that are against it. You know, I don't judge. I don't judge. I'm kind of an observer. I'm fascinated by the human condition. And I've always been fascinated by it. Now, maybe it's because my mom, God bless her, mom, not speaking ill of you, but she was a big drunk man when I was growing up. Still holding the job, still doing the Young and the Restless somehow. I mean, I'd wait at the window at night praying her little red Mustang would show up that she'd make it home and not across the street at wherever that bar was everybody went to back in the day. But, you know, but I've been keen, but even that, I mean, I'm not going to say I don't get emotionally attached. Of course I do to that, to my wife, to my kids, to things, to what's happening in the country. But I've always been fascinated, and I don't know where it came from, with the intricacies of the human condition and how those things, how one thing affects the other, more than getting caught up in like, God, I hate what Trump is doing. I look at it, for instance, there, if we're allowed to go to this place, I look at it and saying, you know, maybe this is just what America needs right now. Not because he's doing such a great job, but if there's racism that exists, there's things that he's bringing out of the woodwork. You know, I try to understand for whatever reason. Well, ultimately, I have a massive, not belief is too weird or it's too religious a word. I have a massive yield to this mystery of God and nature. And I do think in the first film I ever did that I wrote about, it was called Rust, which is all things happen for a reason. I don't know what they are. We can't possibly know. We don't know why we die. We don't know any of this stuff. I don't know if there's heaven, hell. I don't know any of it. I don't know if Allah's going to give you seven birds. I don't know. But I know in my heart there's purpose to all things. And I get interested in stepping back and watching humans in this struggle with each other, trying to understand where the purpose is, you know, and what we're fighting for and all that. So yes, story, the human story is fascinating to me. And I'm going to bring this up because you guys know the world, you know, people, you know, sometimes put soaps in that second class citizen package. And I've always said, like, no, wait a second. It may be they're working fast and furious and you're not getting the time to get the full depth of performance and stuff. And maybe, as with my mother, you know, she could cry on a dime and you're getting that. But what happens there is it really is a study in the human experience. It's why, and the human condition, you know, with a lot of fast objects coming at it, you know, abortion, this, that, you know, in love, out of love, murder, mystery, suicide, you know, it's all in there. But it's a wonderful world of story, and I've always sort of been an advocate for it. I don't know, but yeah, that's me. I like to.
I love that word you used, the word yield, and what a beautiful way to talk about just approaching the human condition, but also the way it sounds like when you approach work, you that lack of judgment, you yield to whatever is there, and you don't judge it, and that. That speaks to, that speaks to your ability to do great work in any scenario, and like that collaborative approach too, right? That ends up being, and so what a beautiful way to approach work, because someone that has your credits could kind of be like, well, I've done this. Why am I doing this?
No, I yield, right. Man. I yield if something feels right. I'll yield if I need the money, you know? But it's interesting that word is on two levels. One is I was talking again to this director who was my first guy who basically on the second day of LA law, I said, Corbin, you've got the job. Stop moving around so much. Stick a pole up your ass. It's still going to save the money. It was his first direction to me.
That's awesome.
And he said, always make it about the work. But it's only recently, which is really interesting, you know, so I don't sound hypocritical. Only in my recent work in the last year have I really started to yield within the work itself. I'll give you a little secret because it applies to all of us. And now I can say it. She'll let me say it. If I ever had to get emotional in a scene, I'd go, God bless you, Mom. I'd say, Mom, I need some help here. I'd go off quietly by myself. I'd feel her. I almost cry thinking about this. I could feel her just touch my back and just say, just hold it. Let's hold it for a while. Let's hold it. All right. I'm going to let you go. You just go. She'd pat me on the back. I swear to God, if I had to get emotional, I couldn't facilitate it myself. And, I've never shared this before, by the way. But I would do that, and that would help me. Maybe it's just the thought of my mom. I don't know what sure. You're gonna feel. I don't know what it was, but I felt her presence, just saying it's okay, let it go. This is what you do. This is what we do. Do this literally until last year, where I started doing some work on The Resident, where I just yielded. I just kind of stopped acting. You know,
wow, yeah,
just stopped acting and yielded to the character a little bit. I've always done that. Back when I even got LA Law, they read thousands of people. And like, I was some guy, if you ever look at it now, I'm like, I think I'm horrible. I got Emmy nominations. That's another whole pile of crap. Right. Anyway, I don't want to get too public about that. Yeah. I yielded even on a certain level there because everybody must have read this Arnie Becker, guy who gets chicks and does all this and got money. And I thought, what a poor son of a bitch this dude is. What a miserable bastard. And then I got the part. But I didn't sort of give in to the obvious of the script. I yielded to what the person was. My mother, I'm going to use a lot of mother stories here because.
Yeah, she's amazing, dude. Please.
You know, my mother, going back to the crying thing, my mother, when I said I want to be an actor, she said, okay. But I'll tell you what, I'm only going to give you my blessing if you go and train. Because if you're just another thing, you're just a pretty boy coming in, going to go get money and cars and women and all that stuff. She said, you can do whatever you want. I love you, but I'm not going to give you my blessing. I'm not going to be behind you in this thing. I went off and trained at UCLA. But in that time, she was so, if you remember, she could just fucking cry on a dime, man. As a lot of women in soaps can, or a lot of people in soaps, I should say. A lot of actors can. But I said to her one day, I said, so how do you get there, Mom? Because now I'm like a 19-year-old killing, out trying to get laid on Sunset Boulevard. Like, how do I cry?
Being able to cry on a dime helps you get laid, I think, right?
Yeah. Well, it does, yeah. She said, she walked me over to a door, showed me the door handle. Strangest story. She walked over to this door and she said, touch that door handle. What? I don't know how to cry. Touch the door handle. I touched the door handle. She said, just hold on to it for a second. She said, now, of all the things in this existence that door handle gets to be and you got to be, it's a door handle. That's all it ever will be. That's all it ever gets to be. You got to be you. And she started crying for the door handle. She taught me empathy for the door handle. It was the most absurd thing, but I got it immediately. It was like, oh, I get it. It's like, and by the way, I'm no more important than the door handle, but that's all it gets to be, you know? And I get to do this. And, so then with that empathy, I started, when I look at characters, going back to the word yield, I started yielding to what they want, who they were. I had, I always said the biggest challenge in the world would probably to play somebody like Hitler or Manson or something. And the challenge as an actor would be, how do I make him not likable, but understandable?
That's always the instinct, right? Is to be like, well, I need to find a way for people to not just think I'm good in this, but like me. And that's hard.
Yeah, well, like me or have empathy,
Sure.
Because again, we won't be very careful on these kinds of waters, someplace they were human and there something happened.
Right.
It changed their thing. They were, I always say every one of us was a child, you know, at one point, you know,
yeah,
an innocent child. I'm not so much believing that we were brought into this world with double horns and evil behind. I think we're a lot of learned stuff, a lot of, you know, a lot of environmental, the way we are that changes us. Yeah. There's some innate things that we are, but, anyway, yield. Yeah, but I started yielding, man, and it's like I'm excited to work now because it's not that I don't care. I don't get in the way of it. I just let this person speak, let them speak. And
so
changed.
So Corbin, is it kind of in your work now a level of freedom that you haven't had before?
And maybe it's that too, yeah, Steve, because I'm here. My kids are kind of raised. I don't have private school. I don't even have college after this year. I don't have.
Congratulations.
Yeah, I don't have to. I'm not saying I have so much money I can stop. My wife and I were just talking this morning. You could, but I'm 65 and I still love to do what I do and I don't want to. You know, could I sit back on some retirement and a few things? Yeah, maybe, but
that's not, I know you, and that's not you.
I don't have to be good in something. I don't have to be good. I can be, I can have people going, you know, what are you doing? Corbin, bring it in, take it back, do that, whatever. But I don't think, you know, I like, you want a little bit of ego, fire me. I don't care.
So when you came to first, we're going to have to talk about Major League at some point.
Okay. Yeah.
Because, well, that's one of Bradford's favorite movies. So I'm going to let him talk.
Well, so, ball right there.
Oh, that's amazing. So coming off of LA Law, timing wise, Roger Dorn. So you talked about how you found Arnie,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Similar place for Roger. Cause I mean, in the most beautiful of ways, he was the most punchable character in movie history. Right. And you did it so beautifully without putting your foot on the gas, just being that, like, you know, and I love that character so much. And so I'm just curious if it was a similar place as Roger Dorn or as Arnie or.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Yeah, it was.
Wait, Corbin, hold on. How did that come about? Was that right? Was that during LA Law?
Yeah. Well, what happened was I was doing a movie during LA Law called, Burt Rigby, You're a Fool, in Arizona. Very funny movie with this guy, Robert Lindsay. And I got a call. I'd grown my hair out because I knew I wanted my hair to be long in this movie, as long as I could get it. And I got a call. We were about a week to go. And they said, hey, some guys just dropped out of this movie, Major League. Charlie Sheen's in it. Tom Berenger is after, you know, Platoon. And this guy, David Ward, who wrote The Sting, wrote it. And I know you, my agent, I don't know if it was our mate, Randy and Miles, might have been, but which was a manager's that we shared. But they knew that I could play baseball. So they said, you want to do a baseball movie? It's kind of like a classic kind of setup as a good baseball movie. I said, well, I'm in the middle of the other movie. He said, well, they'll wait for you. They're already shooting, but they can, if you can get there in a week, you're willing to come right out of it. And they want to get a couple of days. They had to film while in Arizona while they were there. And then they were shutting down and moving back east anyway to Milwaukee. I said, well, what about my hair? And they said, well, they'll deal with it. And I went to Arizona in the middle of making this other movie. And if you look at the first scenes in there, if you go back, when I come in, I do Hats for Bats. And I kind of arrive with that big car and I got a tennis sweater on and we're in the bunkhouse. I actually have super long hair there, but it's all kind of like tucked up behind me. So I got that. And, you know, David, where everybody else, Charlie, Tom, everybody had to show that they could play baseball. And David, I guess they were desperate because they fired this guy and they needed me, and I said yes, and I felt confident enough. Can you look like you play baseball? Yes, I
sure.
can.
Sure, yeah.
Because okay. There's certain people who don't know how to throw a ball. And other sure. people do. That's your basic requirement. And then the fact that you get from third to first is another one.
I've seen enough productions of Damn Yankees on stage to know that it helps to believe that they can actually play baseball.
Or throw a baseball. That's the basic. Yeah, can you look like you've got at least a
sure.
something, you know?
Sure.
So I had enough confidence. I looked Dave in the eye and said, I promise you, yeah. I don't know if I can, you know, be everything that you want. I'm not going to be able to hit it out of the park right. or any of that, but I can make it. I can make it look like I play baseball, and I believe I mean, I can make it look like I play third base.
Right. Right.
Yeah. And I could throw the ball because I actually had a really good arm. I was an outfielder. So the throw from third to first was not, it was like in when you get on a big field, that is like an outfield throw.
It's totally. Well, Steve, the holidays are over. And I don't know about you, but like, even with the best intentions, we always just get a little carried away. And we like
the credit cards take a hit, don't they?
They do a little bit. And it does, you don't feel it at the time. You don't feel it until about a month later, right? You know what I'm saying?
Until you start getting the bills in.
I know. Oh! So if you folks out there are thinking about the high interest credit cards you used over the holidays and the bills that will undoubtedly be coming, here's an idea to ease your mind. Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, back in the day, I used to have a ton of credit cards, and I'd always try to like pay off one credit card with the other and that whole
sure.
thing.
Yeah, it doesn't work so well.
It never really worked out too much. at all. So this is great because you can pay off your credit card balances and save with a credit card consolidation loan from Lightstream.
That's right. You can roll multiple credit card payments into just one payment at a lower fixed rate. And that fixed rate, Lightstream's credit card consolidation loans have rates as low as 5.95% APR with autopay. And that's much lower than the national average.
Which is?
Sometimes over 20%. Can you believe that?
I mean, that's highway robbery.
They get you, man.
This consolidation loan is great because there's no fees, no application fees, no origination fees. They always try to fee you to
right.
death.
So no transaction fees, no prepayment. It's amazing.
Yes. The application is quick and easy. You can apply right from your phone.
Well, that sounds simple.
I love that. That's amazing.
And, you know, when you have good credit, it's nice to know that people pay attention. And Lightstream certainly believes that people with good credit deserve a better loan experience. Because if you work hard for your credit, because gosh, getting good credit can sometimes be hard work.
Yeah. And that interest rate, 5.95, just for our listeners, you apply now, you get a special interest rate discount.
That's right. The only way to get this discount is to go to lightstream.com/awesome. If you want that spelled out, it's lightstream.com/awesome. Get a special interest rate discount for listening to this podcast. How nice.
Yeah, go to lightstream.com.
Subject to credit approval, rate includes 0.50% autopay discount. Terms and conditions apply, and offers are subject to change without notice. Visit lightstream.com/awesome for more information.
Yeah, buddy.
So that's how I got the part. That's what happened. Going back to what the other thing we were saying is I also, when I read the thing, my only fear of doing this was, and I didn't need any money then. That was the thing too. I was actually had a series. I did a couple of movies in the middle of another movie. I said, I'm a little worried, back to our guy, Steve, that represented us. I said, I'm a little worried about, you know, kind of doing the same thing out of LA Law, the same guy, kind of the, you know, the one everybody hates, the schmuck, but I said, I can make him likable. I know that because I know right where this guy's heart is. It's not too far from the Arnie Beckard. They're operating on the same sort of level. You know, add a little athletic twist to this one. You know, it's not different than being a lawyer in a courtroom, I guess. I said, I can do it. And then David called up and really wanted me to do it. So I did it. And I'll say to this day, as much as I loved it and formed great lifelong friendships with people like David and Tommy Berenger and Charlie, who's remained a good friend through the whole time, it might have been a wrong turn.
Really? Why?
Well, I think I had more in me earlier to get to this place I'm at now. I could have made turns. There was another movie I really wanted to do at one point. And again, you know, going back to people we know saying, oh, you got to do this other movie that, it was a movie I really wanted to do with Joel Schumacher called Cousins, which was a remake of a French movie, Cousine. I guess I got approached by Jeffrey Katzenberg, who was at DreamWorks, and like, oh, Jeffrey really wants you in this movie. You got to be in this movie, Shelley Long. And I was like, no, I really want to do this cool movie over here with Joel Schumacher, who'd just done, you know, with Lost Boys or something. And now you got to do this big movie. And I made a couple of easy turns. If I could go back, I don't regret anything. Everything in my life leads to us talking right here.
Sure.
Can't change that path.
It happens for a reason.
All happens for a reason. Thank you, Steve. Right back to it. Yeah. But that was my fear of doing Major League. And, you know, I could argue in hindsight, maybe, you know, then again, maybe I would have never gotten anything else. So, but Major League also paid me a salary, established a price that allowed me at least be in the movie actor realm. To this day, quite frankly, when somebody wants to, you know, have a DVD box and has Corbin Burns in Major League, it is value.
Right. Sure. And, was there, were you a baseball fan as a kid? Were you playing in Major League stadiums?
I played on the Indians in Little League, so that was another omen.
Yeah, right? That's awesome. So was being on a big field like that, was it cool, or was it just so technical and procedural that it wasn't cool?
It was first and foremost just beyond cool. Yeah. I mean, you know, we're sitting there, and by the way, this is before CGI had mastered some arts, and there were 5,000 people in the stands. Today it would be nobody, you know,
sure.
Right. Literally nobody. So we're there, and everything we're doing, we're in the uniforms. It's in back in the day when the uniforms were tight, not this baggy crap that goes on.
Oh yeah. Yeah. You could see everything.
And looking slick. And I'll tell you another funny little funny thing out that. You know, so if you remember back, I don't know if you guys go back, but you know, baseball uniforms were kind of, everything was really tight. That was the thing. And you rolled up your pants under your sanitary socks and all that.
You could see the injection points for the steroids. It was that tight.
Tight. But so I was playing third base, and Steve Yeager, who is the catcher for the Dodgers, was our technical advisor. And he looked at me one day and said, "You wearing a cup?" And I said, "No, man." I said, "Let's just, you know, I get it for safety when you're playing, but on screen, as much as I'd like to look like I'm well endowed, I'm comfortable, but I just think it looked really big. If you did a, you know, sort of a waist, you know, knee up shot of any kind, or even a long shot, you wouldn't see it. But if you did anything where you're just seeing the character foot to head, a cup on those old things, if you ever saw one of those guys, real players, they're like, it's like this bull package, you know, right in front. And I said, you know, I don't want your eye to be drawn to that. I want to make sure the eye gets, as much as I want the eye to be drawn to that, I don't want the eye to be drawn to that. And he goes, "Well, you got to wear a cup, man. You're playing third base. What about when I'm hitting shots down to you that we got to film you getting grounders?" I said, "Steve, it's a movie, man. Man, he used to fly the ball at me. He would just try to get my nuts, man." Right. There's that scene where I'm batting away balls like this, you know. Really? Look at it again. He is zinging them to me with a fungo bat, man.
Were those real baseballs hitting you?
And that one it was.
Well, because you didn't
ever hit me. That was a rubberized version, but I always try to describe it because it's not anything I've ever seen. It's not like a practice ball. Maybe it is of some sort. It's a little softer. It's got a little sponge to it.
Right.
But remember, everything still had to fly off. You know, it's still like, you know, it just had to. Like when I got hit and the other one, you know people go, "Did it hurt?" Well, yeah, it hurt. Right,
sure.
It wasn't like a piece of foam.
Right.
It's still, you know, you can't throw it with any velocity if it's too light.
Right.
So,
I just remember that montage of you just taking grounders and just not getting any of them. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, people always ask, are the bruises real in the locker room? And no, I mean,
no.
I mean, it wasn't that bad, but a few, I mean, I guess a few red spots more than anything.
Yeah. Wow.
That's this. Here it is right here. See balls on the back of me. You see this?
Oh, that's,
they actually made a ball hit me in the back where I go,
that's amazing.
Right. Right. Was the reception to that movie what you guys expected?
I think it was incredible. I mean, you know, I think the movie's made for like $13 million, and it made in those days, I guess that was a good number, like 50, $60 million.
Yeah.
So it did really well. It was never, here's the, you know, going back to, you know, us and our egos, it wasn't Bull Durham.
Oh, jeez.
It wasn't Cool and Sexy with
I don't know, man.
It's a different
Major League. Didn't have
Kevin Costner being cool. It wasn't but it was, yeah, it got well. In today, I mean, I'm, you know, half of me lives off it. I can go out and do hard shows and sports shows as much as I do any other thing.
Right.
I get invited to go do stuff all the time. Didn't get me tickets to the World Series last year in Cleveland, however, which
That is right. That's not right, dude.
That's not right.
No, and it was actually kind of promised. It's weird.
Yeah. I don't know. There's something about Bull Durham didn't have Randy Newman songs. Like I don't know.
It's a different thing. It's cool. That's more of a movie. That's like an indie movie. Yeah. You know? Okay, great. Just, that's not, baseball players, and I've done a lot of different parts. And now I go out, and one thing I do that's really fun is I get invited to minor league stadiums over the course of the summer.
Oh, yeah.
People go do speaking stuff and all that. I go out and I throw out a pitch and hang out and talk and sit with people and all that. Players then and now, we go, that's the most realistic of really what goes on.
Oh, interesting. Yeah.
Yeah. I gotta watch this again.
Oh, dude. It actually
holds up. Major League One.
I gotta watch it.
I've seen two, three's kind of, I actually like three, but nobody else did. Major League really, even in its look, it holds up.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a good, it's cool. David Ward wrote The Sting. David Ward, I can tell you, when I read the Major League script, like the LA Law script, oddly enough, I've been blessed with two incredible pieces of material. You go, okay, I get this thing. I get the characters. He wrote such a tight script that I use it to this day when I'm writing. If there's any kind of, you know, he really taught me by page 30, I better do all this stuff. By page 65, better do this, and you better wrap it up in the next 30. You know, wow. And it's you know, textbook.
That's right. Awesome.
Well, and just so many great actors come. That I mean, of course, you guys had great careers before it, but just you watch it, and Wesley Snipes in his early years, and who was the
Wesley and Dennis Haysbert, and
yeah, who's the female
24?
Yeah, who's the female love interest? Played opposite Tom.
Renee Russo.
Right. Yeah. Right. She had, that was before her, when she was the leading lady for a couple years. Like, it was just, I mean, it was anyway.
In Major League Two, Omar Epps to go. That's right. I mean, so it really had great and really good, some good character actors in it too. Yeah.
So after LA Law, after Major League, what were you looking for next? Or were you just following the work?
After LA Law, I did a little bit of a Burton and I picked up the family and moved to England because wife's English. We got out. You know, when I was on LA Law, that was, I tell people, you got to keep in mind, there was like three networks, or there were four by that time Fox came around. Sure. So there were like 18 shows on TV and there were only three good ones a night, you know. So when you're in something that's a hit, and that was a massive hit, you're like in a big movie for 8 years.
Yeah.
Big movie, because you're doing all the press, all the stuff. You are the TV thing. You are it. You are here, there. Your mind gets consumed by it. You know, opportunity gets, your judgment gets clouded. And again, going back to the person that I think I've become, my wife's English. And, you know, we thought, you know, let's just get out. You know, I mean, not only did the tap turn off of LA Law money weekly, and I didn't want to sit in LA. I saw that doom coming. Like, you don't want to be in LA not making money. And I didn't know what would be next. No actor, you don't know. I mean, I'm sitting here now, like, you know, checking my phone for what. you don't know, man. You try to invent your own stuff in the meantime.
Right. But
we went to England. We escaped, bought a farm, and beautifully had our fourth son there, which is great. So Amanda got to have a, you know, one of our kids in England. He's officially English, you know.
Yeah.
Unbeknownst to us, and again, things for a purpose. She got to spend about 5 years with her dad, who after we moved back, and we did move back just because it was a lot of traveling and whatever, weather and all that, her dad passed soon after. So she actually got to spend five years with her dad. Again, purpose. But I did a show in the middle. I got an offer to do a show the minute we landed in England and started remodeling this farmhouse called The Cape, which was shot in the Kennedy Space Center. Very cool. I was also much like baseball. I loved space growing up and the whole astronaut program and all that. And got to do that. It was a little bit of a disaster. It wasn't what I was promised. But it afforded us to really solidify the move to England and ultimately 3 years later, turn around and pack up. And we're in LA on a holiday and it was really warm. I remember sitting on Sunset Boulevard, the Chateau Marmont, visiting LA. And thinking, like, this is so nice and warm.
I know.
Can't imagine stay there. I went back, packed up the farm, and I came back. But when I was looking, ever since then, I think I spent about 15 years of just drifting to what I had to do, hopefully getting good stuff. You know, there are TV movies. I went back in the middle of it and people, no understanding. It certainly wasn't a James Franco move. And, you know, I talked to, you know, the people at GH and went and did that for a year, you know?
Yeah. Sorry.
Where I really crossed paths with you, Steve.
Yeah. Yeah. So just touching on that a little bit, obviously you grew up, you know, with your mom being on daytime. So you were familiar with it and you didn't really have a preconception of, oh, what the hell is this? And this, right. You know, you understood the process, but even then obviously it was faster than what you were used to on LA Law and movies.
Right.
So was there an adjustment or were you just like, all right, I'm here, let's go. I know it. Cause you always knew your stuff really well. No,
I was not. In fact, one day Tamara called me out, man.
Tamara Braun played Carly. Yes.
I was not. It was a big scene with Tamara, and you know, Tamara is the consummate actress. I mean, she's like, at least she was, she felt like it just, she was there and ready.
Very
and
professional.
I came in one day and, you know, no, I was not used to having, you know, people joke about, you know, 20 pages of dialogue. People don't know. And there ain't no cue cards like there used to be in the days my mom started out. It was like somehow you just know it. And I guess if you get 3/4 of it and you kind of almost hit the marks, it's like moving on. And I was not ready for that. And I had one particularly big day. You know, they always found a big one every, I don't know, couple weeks. And I did not know my shit, man. And she went off on me. Man, you know, in a good way, because it just said you just got to work a little bit harder. So I didn't know as much as I was around it. I didn't know the kind of work that all of you guys did, but I also didn't have the benefit too. I mean, you come into that, like my wife did it. She did GH for a day. Mark brought her in to do a part and hated it, man. Cause she's, I don't know how anybody, I can't know. Pass. I don't want to do this.
Hard pass. Yeah.
You know, hard pass on that one.
That's amazing.
And, it's, people don't know how difficult it is. So I wasn't ready. I can't tell you that I was, you guys all had the benefit. I came in and didn't know anything.
Sure.
You know, you guys had character and you could kind of operate on knowing who you were, you know, Maurice. Yes. And you didn't have to do a lot of homework to become Sonny, you know,
right.
On any given day. But I did something else really interesting I haven't really shared with anybody. And maybe this is, instead of writing a book, I'm doing this podcast with you.
Great. We're happy to help.
No, yeah, you need to write a book. So.
I said, if I'm going to go do this thing, you know, I'm certainly not doing it for the kind of money that I made. I'm not making money, but, you know, nothing like even what you regulars were. I said, I want to find some other purpose in it. And it was part of my acting journey. I said, you don't get a lot of time. I said, I'm going to really work as much as I can. And this is getting toward the yielding thing many years later of like, what do I feel in the moment? What do I, you know, if I'm sick with the flu that day, Corbin, I'm going to bring the flu because it really doesn't matter. I learned soon on, you could be sick. Don't, I mean, your character's not sick. You're not acting sick, but the feeling of being sick, the feeling of having no energy, the feeling of being pissed off. I could bring whatever emotion I wanted and stick it into the words, and they worked. You know, somehow they worked. In fact, they were very alive because maybe it wasn't written that he's angry, but I happen to be angry today for whatever.
Sure.
Or I'm feeling like shit, but I'm winning a celebration. Who's to say you can't win a celebration and feel like shit when you're doing it? So everything is valid in
absolutely
that way, because it's more about the words and the story and pushing story a little bit less about how I feel about it, you know? And so I really used that year, whatever it was, I was there off and on here, maybe a little bit longer, to say, I'm going to be as much in the now with my acting as I can and bring whatever I have on that day and not try to shed that to become something fictional that I'm making up. The words are there. Let me just stick me in them.
Yeah, there's a lot of insight in that, Corbin, because that's one of the things that we have the luxury of doing, right? Because we're living the character every day for 3 years, 5 years, 10 years.
40 years.
40 years. Yeah. So and sometimes obviously the storyline is emotionally exhausting, you know, and you are exhausted.
Right.
So I'm gonna play the scenes exhausted because I'm tired. You know,
and by the way, what if the scene says you're exhausted, but you happen to come in feeling energy? Like, what's wrong in the moment of exhaustion having a moment of energy?
Sure. And sure. So that's down. But there's a lot of insight. Not a lot of people figure that out. We kind of innately figure it out because we're living it. And we're like, hey, I don't have to be this today because I don't feel like that. And I just went through the story. So,
yeah, right.
Yeah. So that's
yeah, you just don't have the amount of work and time and no rehearsal.
Oh, man.
In the end of the day, what I've learned, Steve, is, and it goes back to the yielding, the stories here, very important, the words, the blueprints here, and then there's you. And the most valid thing up on a screen is you. The words and the story take it, the words will take care of the story, the words and what you see visually, that takes mm-hmm. care of the story. The yeah. thing that makes somebody, I'm watching a new series, The Outsider on, just started it last night with, I can't think of his name. Pisses me off. I always forget. Ben Mendelsohn.
Oh, yeah, he's great.
So in the moment, man.
Yeah.
It's just so in the moment. It's slow and lazy, but it's so interesting.
Yeah. You
know? Oh. That's my wife.
Hi, yeah. wife.
She's probably coming to tell me that I have to go soon. How much more time do
we have? Well, we got
whatever you like, man.
We can wrap it up in 5 minutes.
And I can come back, right?
Anytime.
Anytime. Anytime you want to get a next chapter of your book out, we're here for you.
Yes.
Well, let's do this. Let's, because I do have to go somewhere today.
Yeah.
We're actually, yes, we've actually settled in our house, but looking for a new one.
Hey, that sounds like someone I know. Me.
Yeah, right?
But, yeah,
always on the move. Always on the move.
So, yeah, I do have to, but I'd love to go. This is fun.
We'd love to have you. And obviously,
therapy, man.
I know, right?
It's fun to talk. And we'd love to, you know, maybe collaborate on something with you too, because I know your wheels are always turning and so are ours. So I think there might be something that we can do together.
All right. Well, how about we wrap up this chapter?
You got it, brother.
Awesome, man.
Chapter today. We'll call it, man. Chapter one.
Chapter one.
We love chapter one, Corbin.
The book of Corbin, chapter one.
Just in the beginning. When we catch up, we made it to about as far as LA Law ending.
Great. All right. Perfect.
Great.
Sounds great.
This is great. This is a great tease for episode two whenever it happens.
There you go. Corbin, thank you, brother, for your time, man. We appreciate you.
Thank you, guys.
He's got great teeth. God, he's got great teeth.
Great teeth. All right.
All right. Thanks so much, Corbin.
Have a great one. Thanks, Corbin.
All right, thanks, man.
Thank you, brother.
Oh, man.
Awesome.
Awesome, dude.
I just love, listen, Corbin's a great guy, first of all.
It was an honor for me to talk to him. Like I hold him in such high regard. I've always admired his work. I've loved his work and I've loved, you know, his movies. I know, dude.
He's just first of all, he's cool.
Absolutely.
He's a great actor.
Yeah.
And he always brought something to everything he's done. So,
yeah.
And we didn't even scratch the surface with all the stuff that he's done. But I just love talking to people who've been in this business so long.
Yeah.
And still have the passion like this guy has.
For sure.
To keep growing and to keep learning and to try to keep figuring it out.
Yeah.
Because you sure don't have to.
I mean,
you know what I mean? So that's inspiring for me. I'm like, dude, that dude, I mean, cause I know him, but I know some people around him and that dude's always working. I mean, he makes me feel lazy. I'm like, slow down, bro.
He's recurring on two primetime network series as like, that's,
hello.
That's pretty great.
That's pretty amazing. And he's writing stuff and he's doing all these little side movies. I don't even want to say side projects, but
no things that, yeah.
I think there's something that we can do, dude.
Well, and I just love, you know, you can tell when someone talks about their career and the way he does, and he talks about the work, and he talks about, I remember when this director told me this, and I remember when I was doing this at GH, and I remember that at that point, I was just being comfortable and being in the present. Like, you can tell that what he values is experience, relationships.
Yeah.
Where he's not, you know, he doesn't talk with bluster.
No.
Do you know?
He's a real cat. So
yeah. And
that's what's cool. Yeah, I'm so happy he did it too. He saved our bacon.
I know. Yeah. So if you guys are listening to this, We are talking to you only about 12 hours in advance. This is Tuesday morning at 9:30 Pacific time. This will be uploaded tonight. So thank you to Corbin for not only being a fantastic guest, but amazing. for saving our bacon for sure. And dude, I look forward to part two whenever it happens.
Dude, I mean, he's a guy you could just sit down and talk to for hours.
Just ask him two questions and sit back.
Yeah, buddy.
Love that.
Isn't that a great guest?
Oh, I mean, not only is it fascinating and wonderful for us as actors and people just to learn about this man, but as podcast hosts, it's a lot less work.
That's awesome.
Right. So thank you to Corbin.
Yeah, thanks, Corbin.
Till next time. Thank you guys. We're getting geared up for February.
Wow, man. 2020 January was awesome. Thank you to all who came out, by the way. That run was incredible.
Sure was.
For our first new show. It was awesome.
Yeah.
And February's coming up quick, dude.
Yeah.
February's coming up quick, and March, we've got OKC and KC in March. And then
we're saying, 5 weeks? Five weeks to February tour?
Yeah, 5 weeks.
Dallas, San Antonio, Houston, San Diego, San Francisco, Sacramento.
Yeah, buddy.
Oklahoma City and Kansas City in March. And then May.
Sheesh.
May is... yeah. I know.
Get ready, by the way.
Yeah, right.
I know my voice is all messed up from tour.
Blah, 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 blah,
blah, blah, blah.
Yeah,
sounded like that lady in Birmingham. Spadali! Spadali!
We love you, lady in Birmingham.
If you're that lady in Birmingham.
She had a bedazzled cowboy hat, I believe.
Oh, she did. It was like Brett Michaels, dude.
Steve wanted it so bad.
No, I did not.
Yes, you did. Don't.
I would have passed on that one. I would have given that one to Scott Reeves.
Stone Cold and the Jackal.com for all those.
No, hold on, dude. I'm not done.
Oh.
July is going to be interesting.
Oh.
That's all I'm going to say. La, 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 la.
La, 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 la.
Okay. July is going to be interesting, my friend.
Oh, my goodness.
Get ready.
Get ready.
You better tell your wife.
I know, right?
Get ready because we're going. We're going hard. We're going strong.
I love it. I love it so much. I love it so much.
Thank you guys for everything. StoneColdAndTheJackal.com.
Make sure you get on our email list.
Yes, please.
People write us a lot saying, does it cost to be on our email list? It does not cost anything. It's an email list so that we can tell you when we're doing things.
Yes.
There is no cost. So don't be afraid of that. Go to our website, get on our list so that you don't miss anything. That's really what it's for.
Yeah.
Thank you guys. Thank you to Corbin. We'll be talking to you guys next week.
Later.
Expeditiously with Tip T.I. Harris is starting off the new year with two amazing episodes you won't want to miss. First, he's talking with Taraji P. Henson, star of Empire, about her career in film and television.
And then Tip sits down with Mike Tyson.
Ow.
Yeah, buddy, for a no-holds-bar interview that is both hilarious and informative. Be sure to subscribe on Podcast One, Apple Podcasts, and many other podcast apps so you can get new episodes every week.